This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents The Man in the High Castle by Philip K. Dick. To my wife, Tessa, and my son, Christopher, with great and awful love. Chapter 1. For a week, Mr. R. Children had been anxiously watching the mail, but the valuable shipment from the Rocky Mountain States had not arrived. As he opened up his store on Friday morning and saw only letters on the floor by the mail slot, he thought, "I'm going to have an angry customer." Pouring himself a cup of instant tea from the 5-cent wall dispenser, he got a broom and began to sweep. Soon he had the front of American Artistic Handicrafts Incorporated ready for the day, all spick and span with the cash register full of change, a fresh vase of marigolds, and the radio playing background music. Outdoors along the sidewalk, businessmen hurried toward their offices along Montgomery Street. Far off, a cable car passed. Children halted to watch it with pleasure. Women in their long, colorful silk dresses. He watched them, too. Then the phone rang. He turned to answer it. "Yes," a familiar voice said to his answer. Children's heart sank. "This is Mr. Tagomi. Did my Civil War recruiting poster arrive yet, sir? Please recall, you promised it sometime last week." The fussy, brisk voice, barely polite, barely keeping the code. "Did I not give you a deposit, sir, Mr. Children, with that stipulation? This is to be a gift, you see. I explained that. A client."
"Extensive inquiries," Children began, "which I've had made at my own expense, Mr. Tagomi, sir, regarding the promised parcel, which you realize originates outside of this region, and is therefore—"
But Tagomi broke in.
"Then it has not arrived?"
"No, Mr. Tagomi, sir."
An icy pause.
"I can wait no further more," Tagomi said.
"No, sir."
Children gazed morosely through the store window at the warm, bright day and the San Francisco office buildings.
"A substitute, then. Your recommendation, Mr. Children?"
Tagomi deliberately mispronounced the name, insult within the code that made Children's ears burn. Place pulled. The dreadful mortification of their situation. Robert Children's aspirations and fears and torments rose up and exposed themselves, swamped him, stopping his tongue. He stammered, his hand sticky on the phone. The air of his store smelled of the marigolds. The music played on, but he felt as if he were falling into some distant sea.
"Well," he managed to mutter, "butter churn? Ice cream maker circa 1900?
His mind refused to think. Just when you forgot about it, just when you fool yourself. He was 38 years old, and he could remember the pre-war days, the other times. Franklin D. Roosevelt and the World's Fair. The former, better world.
"Could I bring various desirable items out to your business location?" he mumbled.
An appointment was made for 2 o'clock. Have to shut store, he knew as he hung up the phone. No choice. Have to keep goodwill of such customers. Business depends on them. Standing shakily, he became aware that someone, a couple, had entered the store. Young man and girl, both handsome, well-dressed, ideal. He calmed himself and moved professionally, easily, in their direction, smiling. They were bending to scrutinize a counter display, had picked up a lovely ashtray. Married, he guessed. Live out in City of the Winding Mists, the new exclusive apartments on Skyline overlooking Belmont.
"Hello,"
he said, and felt better. They smiled at him without any superiority, only kindness. His displays, which really were the best of their kind on the coast, had awed them a little. He saw that and was grateful. They understood.
"Really excellent pieces, sir,"
the young man said. Children bowed spontaneously. Their eyes, warm not only with human bond, but with the shared enjoyment of the art objects he sold, their mutual tastes and satisfactions, remained fixed on him. They were thanking him for having things like these for them to see, pick up and examine, handle perhaps without even buying. Yes, he thought, they know what sort of store they are in. This is not tourist trash, not redwood plaques reading Muir Woods, Marin County, PSA, or funny signs or girly rings or postcards or views of the bridge. The girl's eyes especially, large, dark. How easily, Children thought, I could fall in love with a girl like this. How tragic my life, then, as if it weren't bad enough already. The stylish black hair, lacquered nails, pierced ears for the long dangling brass handmade earrings.
"Your earrings," he murmured. "Purchased here, perhaps?"
"No," she said. "At home." Children nodded. No contemporary American art. Only the past could be represented here in a store such as his.
"You are here for long?"
he asked.
"To our San Francisco?"
"I'm stationed here indefinitely," the man said, "with standard of living for unfortunate areas planning commission of inquiry." Pride showed on his face. Not the military. Not one of the gum-chewing, boorish draftees with their greedy peasant faces wandering up Market Street, gaping at the bawdy shows, the sex movies, the shooting galleries, the cheap nightclubs with photos of middle-aged blondes holding their nipples between their wrinkled fingers and leering. The honky-tonk jazz slums that made up most of the flat part of San Francisco, rickety tin and board shacks that had sprung up from the ruins even before the last bomb fell. No, this man was of the elite. Cultured, educated, even more so than Mr. Tagomi, who was, after all, a high official with a ranking trade mission on the Pacific coast. Tagomi was an old man. His attitudes had formed in the War Cabinet days.
"Had you wished American traditional ethnic art objects as a gift?" Sheldon asked. "Or to decorate, perhaps, a new apartment for your stay here?"
"If the latter," his heart picked up.
"An accurate guess," the girl said. "We are starting to decorate. A bit undecided. Do you think you could inform us?"
"I could arrange to arrive at your apartment, yes," Sheldon said. "Bringing several hand cases I can suggest in context at your leisure. This, of course, is our specialty."
He dropped his eyes so as to conceal his hope. There might be thousands of dollars involved.
"I am getting in a New England table, maple, all wood-pegged, no nails, immense beauty and worth, and a mirror from the time of the 1812 war, and also the Aboriginal art, a group of vegetable-dyed goat-hair rugs."
"I myself," the man said, "prefer the art of the cities."
"Yes," Sheldon said eagerly. "Listen, sir, I have a mural from WPA post office period, original, done on board, four sections, depicting Horace Greeley. Priceless collector's item."
"Ah," the man said, his dark eyes flashing.
"And a Victrola cabinet of 1920, made into a liquor cabinet."
"Ah."
"And, sir, listen, framed signed picture of Jean Harlow."
The man goggled at him.
"Shall we make arrangements?"
Sheldon said, seizing this correct psychological instant. From his inner coat pocket he brought his pen, notebook.
"I shall take your name and address, sir and lady."
Afterward, as the couple strolled from his store, Sheldon stood, hands behind his back, watching the street. Joy. If all business days were like this. But it was more than business, the success of his store. It was a chance to meet a young Japanese couple socially, on a basis of acceptance of him as a man, rather than him as a Yank, or at best, a tradesman who sold art objects. Yes, these new young people of the rising generation, who did not remember the days before the war, or even the war itself, they were the hope of the world. Place difference did not have the significance for them. It will end, Sheldon thought. Someday, the very idea of place. Not governed and governing, but people. And yet he trembled with fear, imagining himself knocking at their door. He examined his notes. The kasuras. Being admitted, no doubt offered tea. Would he do the right thing? Know the proper act and utterance at each moment? Or would he disgrace himself like an animal by some dismal faux pas? The girl's name was Betty. Such understanding in her face, he thought. The gentle, sympathetic eyes. Surely, even in the short time in the store, she had glimpsed his hopes and defeats. His hopes. He felt suddenly dizzy. What aspirations bordering on the insane, if not the suicidal, did he have? But it was known, relations between Japanese and Yanks, although generally it was between a Japanese man and a Yank woman. This. He quailed at the idea. And she was married. He whipped his mind away from the pageant of his involuntary thoughts and began busily opening the morning's mail. His hands, he discovered, were still shaking. And then he recalled his 2 o'clock appointment with Mr. Tagomi. At that, his hands ceased shaking and his nervousness became determination. "I've got to come up with something acceptable," he said to himself, Where? How? What? A phone call. Sources. Business ability. Scrape up a fully restored 1929 Ford, including fabric top. Black. Grand Slam to keep patronage forever. Crated original mint tri-motor airmail plane discovered in barn in Alabama, etc. Produce mummified head of Mr. B. Bill, including flowing white hair. Sensational American artifact. Make my reputation in top connoisseur circles throughout Pacific, not excluding home islands. To inspire himself, he lit up a marijuana cigarette. Excellent Landa Smiles brand. In his room on Hayes Street, Frank Frink lay in bed wondering how to get up. Sun glared past the blind onto the heap of clothes that had fallen to the floor. His glasses, too. Would he step on them? Try to get to bathroom by other route, he thought. Crawl or roll. His head ached, but he did not feel sad. Never look back, he decided. Time? The clock on the dresser. 11:30. Good grief. But still he lay. I'm fired, he thought. Yesterday he had done wrong at the factory, spouted the wrong kind of talk to Mr. Wyndham Matson, who had a dished-in face with Socrates-type nose, diamond ring, gold fly zipper. In other words, a power, a throne. Frink's thoughts wandered groggily. Yes, he thought, and now they'll blacklist me. My skill is no use, I have no trade. 15 years' experience, gone. And now he would have to appear at the Laborers' Justification Commission for a revision of his work category. Since he had never been able to make out Wyndham Matson's relationship to the Pinocks, the puppet white government at Sacramento, he could not fathom his ex-employer's power to sway the real authorities, the Japanese. The LJC was Pinock-run. He would be facing 4 or 5 middle-aged, plump white faces on the order of Wyndham Matson's. If he failed to get justification there, he would make his way to one of the import-export trade missions which operated out of Tokyo, and which had offices throughout California, Oregon, Washington, and the parts of Nevada included in the Pacific States of America. But if he failed successfully to plead there... Plans roamed his mind as he lay in bed, gazing up at the ancient light fixture in the ceiling. He could, for instance, slip across into the Rocky Mountain states, but it was loosely banded to the PSA and might extradite him. What about the South? His body recoiled. Ugh, not that. As a white man, he would have plenty of place, in fact, more than he had here in the PSA. But he did not want that kind of place. And worse, the South had a cat's cradle of ties, economic, ideological, and God knew what, with the Reich, and Frank Frink was a Jew. His original name was Frank Fink. He had been born on the East Coast in New York, and in 1941 he had been drafted into the Army of United States of America, right after the collapse of Russia. After the Japs had taken Hawaii, he had been sent to the West Coast. When the war ended, there he was on the Japanese side of the settlement line. And here he was today, 15 years later. In 1947, on Capitulation Day, he had more or less gone berserk. Hating the Japs as he did, he had vowed revenge. He had buried his service weapons 10 feet underground, in a basement, well wrapped and oiled, for the day he and his buddies arose. However, time was the great healer, a fact he had not taken into account. When he thought of the idea now, the great bloodbath, the purging of the Pinocks and their masters, he felt as if he were reviewing one of those stained yearbooks from his high school days, coming upon an account of his boyhood aspirations. Frank Goldfish Fink is going to be a paleontologist and vows to marry Norma Prout. Norma Prout was the class Schönes Mädchen, and he really had vowed to marry her. That was all so goddamn long ago, like listening to Fred Allen or seeing a W.C. Fields movie. Since 1947, he had probably seen or talked to 600,000 Japanese, and the desire to do violence to any or all of them had simply never materialized after the first few months. It just was not relevant anymore. But wait, there was one, a Mr. Omuro, who had bought control of a great area of rental property in downtown San Francisco, and who for a time had been Frank's landlord. There was a bad apple, he thought. A shark who had never made repairs, had partitioned rooms smaller and smaller, raised rents. Omuro had gouged the poor, especially the nearly destitute jobless ex-servicemen during the Depression years of the early 50s. However, it had been one of the Japanese trade missions which had cut off Omuro's head for his profiteering. And nowadays, such a violation of the harsh, rigid, but just Japanese civil law was unheard of. It was a credit to the incorruptibility of the Jap occupation officials, especially those who had come in after the war cabinet had fallen. Recalling the rugged, stoic honesty of the trade missions, Frink felt reassured. Even Wyndham Matson would be waved off like a noisy fly, WM Corporation owner or not. At least, so he hoped. "I guess I really have faith in this co-prosperity Pacific Alliance stuff," he said to himself. Strange. Looking back to the early days, it had seemed such an obvious fake then. Empty propaganda. But now... He rose from the bed and unsteadily made his way to the bathroom. While he washed and shaved, he listened to the midday news on the radio.
"Let us not deride this effort,"
the radio was saying as he momentarily shut off the hot water.
"No, we won't," Frink thought bitterly. He knew which particular effort the radio had in mind. Yet there was, after all, something humorous about it. The picture of stolid, grumpy Germans walking around on Mars, on the red sand where no humans had ever stepped before. Lathering his jowls, Frink began a chanting satire to himself.
"Gott, Herr Kreisleiter, ist dies willigt der Ort, wo man das Konzentrationslager bilden kann? Das Wetter ist so schön, heiß, aber doch schön."
The radio said, "Co-prosperity civilization must pause and consider whether in our quest to provide a balanced equity of mutual duties and responsibilities, coupled with remunerations..."
Typical jargon from the ruling hierarchy, Frink noted.
"We have not failed to perceive the future arena in which the affairs of man will be acted out, be they Nordic, Japanese, Negroid."
On and on it went. As he dressed, he mulled with pleasure his satire. "The weather is schön, so schön, but there is nothing to breathe." However, it was a fact. The Pacific had done nothing toward colonization of the planets. It was involved, bogged down, rather, in South America. While the Germans were busy bustling enormous robot construction systems across space, the Japs were still burning off the jungles in the interior of Brazil, erecting 8-floor clay apartment houses for ex-headhunters. By the time the Japs got their first spaceship off the ground, the Germans would have the entire solar system sewed up tight. Back in the quaint old history book days, the Germans had missed out while the rest of Europe put the final touches on their colonial empires. However, Frink reflected, they were not going to be last this time. They had learned. And then he thought about Africa and the Nazi experiment there, and his blood stopped in his veins, hesitated, at last went on. That huge empty ruin. The radio said,
"We must consider with pride, however, our emphasis on the fundamental physical needs of peoples of all place, their sub-spiritual aspirations, which must be..."
Frink shut the radio off. Then, calmer, he turned it back on. Christ on the crapper, he thought. Africa. For the ghosts of dead tribes. Wiped out to make a land of... what? Who knew? Maybe even the master architects in Berlin did not know. Bunch of automatons building and toiling away. Building. Grinding down. Ogres out of a paleontology exhibit, at their task of making a cup from an enemy's skull, the whole family industriously scooping out the contents, the raw brains, first to eat, then useful utensils of men's leg bones. Thrifty, to think not only of eating the people you did not like, but eating them out of their own skull. The first technicians. Prehistoric man in a sterile white lab coat in some Berlin University lab, experimenting with uses to which other people's skull, skin, ears, fat could be put to.
Ja, Herr Doktor.
A new use for the big toe. See, one can adapt the joint for a quick-acting cigarette lighter mechanism. Now if only Herr Krupp can produce it in quantity.
It horrified him, this thought, the ancient, gigantic, cannibal near-man flourishing now, ruling the world once more. We spent 1,000,000 years escaping him, Frink thought, and now he's back. And not merely as the adversary, but as the master.
We can deplore, the radio, the voice of the little yellow bellies from Tokyo, was saying. God, Frink thought, and we called them monkeys, these civilized, bandy-legged shrimps, who would no more set up gas ovens than they would melt their wives into sealing wax.
And we have deplored, often in the past, the dreadful waste of humans in this fanatical striving which sets the broader mass of men wholly outside the legal community.
They, the Japs, were so strong on law.
To quote a Western saint familiar to all, What profit a man if he gain the whole world, but in this enterprise lose his soul?
The radio paused. Frink, tying his tie, also paused. It was the morning ablution. I have to make my pact with them here, he realized. Blacklisted or not, it'd be death for me if I left Japanese-controlled land and showed up in the South or in Europe, anywhere in the Reich. I'll have to come to terms with old Wyndham Matson. Seated on his bed, a cup of lukewarm tea beside him, Frink got down his copy of the I Ching. From their leather tube, he took the 49 yarrow stalks. He considered until he had his thoughts properly controlled and his questions worked out. Aloud, he said, "How should I approach Wyndham Matson in order to come to decent terms with him?" He wrote the question down on the tablet, then began whipping the yarrow stalks from hand to hand until he had the first line, the beginning, an 8, half the 64 hexagrams eliminated already. He divided the stalks and obtained the second line. Soon, being so expert, he had all 6 lines. The hexagram lay before him, and he did not need to identify it by the chart. He could recognize it as hexagram 15. Qian, modesty. Ah, the low will be raised up, the high brought down, powerful families humbled. He did not have to refer to the text, he knew it by heart. A good omen. The oracle was giving him favorable counsel. And yet he was a bit disappointed. There was something fatuous about hexagram 15. Too goody-goody. Naturally he should be modest. Perhaps there was an idea in it, however. After all, he had no power over old W.M. He could not compel him to take him back. All he could do was adopt the point of view of hexagram 15. This was that sort of moment when one had to petition, to hope, to await with faith. Heaven in its time would raise him up to his old job, or perhaps even to something better. He had no lines to read, no 9s or 6s. It was static. So he was through. It did not move into a second hexagram. A new question, then. Setting himself, he said aloud, "Will I ever see Juliana again?" That was his wife, or rather his ex-wife. Juliana had divorced him a year ago, and he had not seen her in months. In fact, he did not even know where she lived. Evidently, she had left San Francisco, perhaps even the PSA. Either their mutual friends had not heard from her, or they were not telling him. Busily, he maneuvered the yarrow stalks, his eyes fixed on the tallies. How many times he had asked about Juliana, one question or another. Here came the hexagram, brought forth by the passive chance workings of the vegetable stalks. Random, and yet rooted in the moment in which he lived, in which his life was bound up with all other lives and particles in the universe. The necessary hexagram picturing in its pattern of broken and unbroken lines the situation. He, Juliana, the factory on Gough Street, the trade missions that ruled, the exploration of the planets, the billion chemical heaps in Africa that were now not even corpses, the aspirations of the thousands around him in the shanty warrens of San Francisco, the mad creatures in Berlin with their calm faces and manic plans, all connected in this moment of casting the yarrow stalks to select the exact wisdom appropriate in a book begun in the 30th century B.C., a book created by the sages of China over a period of 5,000 years, winnowed, perfected, that superb cosmology and science, codified before Europe had even learned to do long division. The hexagram. His heart dropped. 44. Coup. Coming to meet. Its sobering judgment. The maiden is powerful. One should not marry such a maiden. Again he had gotten it in connection with Juliana. Ay vey, he thought, settling back. So she was wrong for me. I know that. I didn't ask that. Why does the oracle have to remind me? A bad fate for me, to have met her and been in love, be in love with her. Juliana, the best-looking woman he had ever married. Soot-black eyebrows and hair, trace amounts of Spanish blood distributed as pure color even to her lips. Her rubbery, soundless walk. She had worn saddle shoes left over from high school. In fact, all her clothes had a dilapidated quality and the definite suggestion of being old and often washed. He and she had been so broke so long that despite her looks, she had to wear a cotton sweater, cloth-zippered jacket, brown tweed skirt, and bobby socks. And she hated him and it because it made her look, she had said, like a woman who played tennis, or, even worse, collected mushrooms in the woods. But above and beyond everything else, He had originally been drawn by her screwball expression. For no reason, Juliana greeted strangers with a portentous, nudnik Mona Lisa smile that hung them up between responses, whether to say hello or not. And she was so attractive that more often than not they did say hello, whereupon Juliana glided by. At first he had thought it was just plain bad eyesight, but finally he had decided that it revealed a deep-dyed, otherwise concealed stupidity at her core. And so, finally, her borderline flicker of greeting to strangers had annoyed him, as had her plant-like, silent, I'm-on-a-mysterious-errand way of coming and going. But even then, toward the end, when they had been fighting so much, he still never saw her as anything but a direct, literal invention of God's, dropped into his life for reasons he would never know. And on that account, a sort of religious intuition of faith about her, he could not get over having lost her. She seemed so close right now, as if he still had her. That spirit, still busy in his life, padding through his room in search of whatever it was Juliana sought, and in his mind, whenever he took up the volumes of the Oracle. Seated on his bed, surrounded by a lonely disorder, preparing to go out and begin his day, Frank Frink wondered who else in the vast, complicated city of San Francisco was at this same moment consulting the Oracle. And were they all getting as gloomy advice as he? Was the tenor of the moment as adverse for them as it was for him?